Well, here we go.
Supatipanno
Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Ujjupatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Yayapatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Samichipatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Yaditang Chatavi Purisa Yugani Atta Purisa Pugala Esa Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Ahuneyo Pahuneyo Dakineyo Anjali Karaniyo Anutarang Punyaketang Lokasa Tamahang Sangang Abhipujayami Tamahang Sangang Sirasanamami.
Upwards and unbounded, free
from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Very good. Excellent. Oops, sorry. Could you get my teddy bear back? Thank you. Very good. Ooh, a lot of questions today. So I better be brief with them. Not going off on tangents. Dear Ajahn, thank you. Sometimes when I meditate, I see visions. Sometimes when I sleep, I make dreams. How to tell whether I'm sleeping or meditating? It's whether you're snoring. No. One of the ways you tell for sure that it's a meditation, not falling asleep, is how you feel afterwards. Because if it's a meditation, a deep meditation, you feel full of energy afterwards. But if you're falling asleep, you feel sort of dull afterwards. So that's the easiest way to find out whether it's sleep or whether it's meditating. Just the effect afterwards. Just the usual way is that when a person gets into deep meditation, the five hindrances get subdued. The wanting, the ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and doubt. So what happens is that after the meditation you feel really clear. There's no sleepiness there's no restlessness, you're poised. And it's a very different feeling. And that's where you know that, yeah, that's a really nice meditation, you feel really good. So that's the best way. In the time, maybe you can't tell the difference, but afterwards you certainly can. Anyway, still referring to yesterday's question about being a monk, leaving the family, including spouse and kids, what about the Buddha Gautama? Wasn't he still have responsibility towards the ex-wife and so on? He just left everything behind. First of all, his mum had died, but he had responsibility there. But he had, obviously, living in a very wealthy home with lots of support for his wife and child, with an extended family. It wasn't such a terrible thing. He wasn't leaving his wife and son destitute. They had a really, really extended, good family to look after them. And of course, even at that time, when he left, he wasn't a Buddha yet. You know, he was a man trying to search for things that, oh, I don't know, that if you could have told the future, he said, oh, yeah, it's a wonderful thing he did. But even at that time, some people would say it's reprehensible to leave his wife and young son. And because even though he may have had an extended family and plenty of resources and wealth to look after his wife and his son, nevertheless, you know, there must have been some emotional turmoil for his wife and child. But we don't know exactly what happened and just why that occurred. Even these days, families, they split up. And it gets really complicated these days. There's one man who was He was a monk who was made, and he had, I think, three mothers and four fathers, because his first parents, they had a difficulty, and so they had him adopted out, and then his adopted parents, who thought, you know, it was his real parents, they split up and they each married and a second partner, and it got very complicated. You know, who was his real mum and dad and stepmom and stepdad, but in one sense, it was a nice, happy family. He had more parents, you know, to actually look after him. But even so, the Buddha Gautama, he did sort of have an extended family, Siddhartha Gautama, a spouse and kids. He only had actually one kid. But anyway, that it really depends on the circumstances, the situation. And if you can actually just say that, yes, you do have support, a real good support for your wife and kids, then it's, you know, maybe, but usually I would ask for real support from your parents, from your rest of your family. You know, we do have nuclear families these days, which is a shame. The old days you'd had uncles and aunts all over the place and all living in the same house. So that meant that, you know, you had many, many people to look after you and care for you. So if you just happened to lose a father, or it wouldn't be so desperately felt. Anyway, this question. If a person is seriously ill in coma and needs life-supporting equipment to survive, and a family member decides to switch off the machines in order to end the suffering, is that considered an act of killing? If it is in order to end the suffering, it might be considered to be an act of killing. But likewise, if I'm in the same situation, I don't want to have life support equipment, is it considered suicide? Thank you. Now, first of all, there's two different questions. They should really be separated. If that is your family member, and you are, say, the eldest son, or you are the person who's got the right of attorney, and the doctor comes and asks you, you know, that's, the person has got no hope of survival, there is no possibility that they can continue living, can I please have permission to turn off the life support? And what do you do? Because that's a very difficult situation. Some people think, oh my goodness, that could be that's my father there, and killing your father is supposed to be, and your mother or father, is considered to be something which will prevent you ever getting enlightened in this lifetime. That's serious business, let alone the fact that that's your mum and dad, or mum or dad, not both. And so how do you solve that problem? And of course, I love telling real stories rather than theories, because there was a Vietnamese family here, and their father, he was supposed to survive the bypass surgery. But every now and again, sort of the shock to the heart is just too great. And so the father was in the ICU, and the doctors said that, you know, he's going. And the family didn't want that to happen at all. It was a bit of a shock. They never expected him to actually to die. So they brought Ajahn Brahm in again, and so I did my chanting, but not just chanting. You know, anybody can do this. I always have to be really careful, because sometimes as a monk, you're not supposed to mention you're anything special, only psychic powers or stuff. But then it's sometimes frustrating, because I think I'm okay with this one, because you just sense that person, their father, was not dead, but he was really struggling, needed some energy to pull through. So I did some chanting and meditation, and I felt that he received that energy, and he was really, looks like he was going to pull through. And to this day, I don't know how I managed this, but I went about two or three times every day for about, I don't know how many days. And every time, he was very close to death, and you just give some he was struggling, he just needed a bit of encouragement. To me, it's just like somebody who's playing, say, tennis, and your mum or dad's on the side there cheering you on, encouraging you, and you raise your game. So, and I was actually helping him raise his game, and he was pulling through again. And for about, those days, he was on the edge of life and death. And all that time. And I remember they called me once, and at the end of this whole series of trying to get him to pull through. And then I went into the room, because I'd been there, about 9 or 10 times. Went in the room to his bedside, and you felt it was very different. You felt he wasn't there anymore. He died. And, I said, well, there's not much point in me chanting now, because he's gone. His stream of consciousness had left. And I remember I said, I can't say this, but, if you turn off the machine now, you're not killing him, he's gone, he's already dead. And I remember just the reaction to the head nurse and the doctor who was in attendance at the time. These were specialists, that's their job, working in the ICU. And I remember them looking at me and going, confirming, that what as a monk who's just sensitive, that you felt, and that's actually what was happening. So how can you call that killing or murder when there's no one left? They've already disappeared. There's a lot of difference between a person who is just a shell, just a bodily machine being kept alive by another machine, and a person who's actually got some life force inside. And you don't need to be super meditated to know that. There's another person, I can't say who she is because some of you may know her, but she was, her father, no sorry, her mum, I forget that wrong. Her mother had Coif-Jacobson disease. They used to call it mad cow disease. And so she was in the hospital for quite a long time. And I just happened to be passing through, and so they invited me to go and sort of see her. And she was the first day I went to see her. She was, obviously unconscious and very sick, but you got the feeling she was really tired, fighting that disease. And I did some chanting for her, and the next day I went there again, and she said, "Well, she's changed. She too has gone." I don't know if it was me just going there and just seeing a monk and giving some confidence to her to really let go. But you can feel that the situation next to that person has changed. And you can sense their stream of consciousness, their mind, if you like, is no longer there. It's just a body just doing its thing. So those are the things which you can do. And obviously, if that's the case, you feel that there's no one there, it's just the shell, then, of course, if you tell the doctor to turn off the machine, how can you call it killing? It's already dead. It disappears, because the ventilator makes your thing go up and down. And I think you can do that pretty accurately these days. So that can't be considered killing, because they're already dead. But be very careful, because if you want to switch off the machine in order to end your father or mother's suffering, now that is killing. If you think they're alive and they're conscious but they're suffering, basically it's not your job to end another person's suffering. It's you're really not putting them out of their suffering, you're putting them out of your own suffering, because you don't like to see someone you love and care for in so much pain. And that can be just a very, very dangerous thing to do. Because sometimes they're suffering, but they're handling it. And the story there is, it's again, you may not think it's related, but this was the person with their pets. And this was that story of Judy. And Judy had a lovely dog, where the dog got cancer, you know, this is, you know, people you really care for and like, and the old fur babies, as I was saying these days, are replacing real babies because people get so much emotional satisfaction from their own little dog. So anyway, that she spent a lot of money trying to cure the cancer this little dog had, until it came the time that the cancer was so advanced, taking it to another appointment at the veterinary doctor. And the veterinary doctor said, "No, it's gone too far. Your dog's in a lot of suffering, a lot of pain. I've got to give it the injection to kill it, to euthanize it, to put it down." We have all these words, you know, for you know, killing something. And it reminded me of the story of the fellow who took his Labrador dog, you know, to the vet. And, you know, it was only just for a checkup. But, you know, the vet picked up that dog and looked at it and said, "I've got to put it down." I said, "Well, there's nothing wrong with the dog. You can't kill it." "Yes, I know, I've got to put it down because it's too heavy." Not a killer. We have all these weird names for this. Okay, another vet joke. And so the guy later on took his dog to the vet and he said, "There's something wrong with my dog." And the vet said, "Your dog is dead." He said, "He can't be dead. He, you know, he's just not dead. No, just do something." You know, people get in denial sometimes. You know, when someone you love like a dog is a bit sick. And the vet said, "Look, it's dead." "So I don't believe it," said the owner. Okay, so the vet put the dog on the table, didn't move, and he went to one of the other cages and got out a cat. And he took the cat, and the cat was meow, was not very happy, and put the cat's nose almost straight onto the nose of the dog. And the cat... But the dog didn't do anything. The dog just sat, lay down there. And the owner said, "Well, that's weird because my dog doesn't like cats." So he took the cat around the back of the dog, lifted up the tail to the dog's private parts. Again, the cat went, the dog never moved, turned the dog upside down on the soft belly and put the cat on the soft belly. Again, the cat was trying to scratch the dog and the dog never responded. And the owner said, "Wow, my dog must be dead after all, because it never liked cats. It would never allow a cat to do anything like that to it." Okay, so the vet put the cat back in the cage and then sort of, you know, put the little dog in a box so the man could take it back and bury it in his garden. And then the vet gave the bill to the guy, $1,010. "What? That's really expensive." "It's usually only $10. "Yes, $10 for the examination and $1,000 for the CAT scan." Okay. Anyway, what was I? Oh, yeah. But anyway, Judy. So, she had this moral dilemma. The cat was very sick, really suffering, and she had the choice to actually tell the vet to inject it or just whatever. And I've told many people about this before. If it is, especially a pet, someone you've known and loved and cared for, she asks, "Can I just spend a few moments with my cat alone? My dog, sorry." So she cradled it in her arms, looked it in the face, eye contact, and in privacy she asks her dog, "Do you want to die? Have you had enough pain?" Simple question, and then waited for the answer. She felt the answer. It's not the dog was speaking to her, but you know that this dog, you know, the eye contact, you feel what it wants. And she said she got a very clear message from her dog, no, I'm not ready to die yet. So she took the dog back to the vet and said, no, I'm taking it home. And that was where the vet, I've told this story many times before, but it really is a true story and it's a great story. The vet was very upset. She knew that Judy was a Buddhist, and you Buddhists are just so selfish. You talk about kindness and compassion, but you know, yeah, that dog is suffering. You should let me put it down. No. And so the vet was very upset because the vets care for animals. And when, for some religious reason, that's what the vet thought, they take the dog back home to suffer more, he was really upset at that. But anyway, Judy took the dog back home, and around six months later, she took the dog back to the vet because the dog had made a full recovery. And the dog knew how serious the sickness was and what was going on. The dog knows its own body and knows that now he's got a really good chance, so you know, let me see if I can overcome this sickness. And the dog did. And when the vet examined the dog again, Judy told me that the vet's attitude totally changed. You Buddhists are very wise. Or whatever. So sometimes, if you have even, you know, somebody who is very close to you, a person, by the bedside, you ask a question, you know, are you still alive? But you can't ask a question, you know, if you only do that for a dog because the dog can't actually speak to the vet, so you have to pass a message on. And if you pass a message on from your dog to the vet, he's had enough, please inject it. You are not killing your dog. You're actually passing on the dog's wishes to the vet. It's the dog's decision. It's the pet's decision. It's not yours. The same with sort of turning off the machine when it's your father or mother there. It's not your decision to do that. We are the owners of our karma. We're responsible for our karma. It's up to us. And in the same way, if someone commits suicide, it's their job. Or not suicide so much as voluntary euthanasia. Voluntary euthanasia means that you decide yourself, you know, that now is the time to end your life. And you decide that when you are fully competent, you're not depressed or having a bad day, and you're not coerced by others, you're fully in command of your decision-making faculties and you're well-informed. And so it's called voluntary assisted dying. In other words, that the doctors or the nurses, whatever it is, you know, they put the needles into your flesh, and you have the opportunities, you're competent, and you can press the buttons on the computer or click the mouse, a series of steps, and I remember seeing just what happens, and it's a video, the number of steps you have to do until you get to that final point. If you press this button, the life-killing chemicals will be let into the bloodstream, and you will pass away. And sometimes it's very beautiful that the family are all around, they're ready to go. It's not a shock anymore. You're not struggling. Maybe there's one last chance. A very dignified way to go. But it has to be the individual's choice. No one else could choose that for you. You have to make that decision. Incompetence in sort of clear will. So there's a lot of religious dogmatism and fear and not really understanding the process of dying. And these days, because life has been extended, much longer lifespan than we used to have, we do come across these many diseases. And of course, some of them are just very unpleasant to bear. I don't know about you, but I've been visiting people who are really, really sick. And in hospitals with the best palliative care. And You recall this one gentleman, he just said, can't you take me round the back and shoot me? You know, he was just really hurting, constantly, 24/7. You know, obviously, the time came and he died, and you'd felt very relieved that the end had come. So, it's a person's choice. And respect that choice, because we are the owners of our karma, heirs to our karma. The next question, how to be patient? I will answer that question tomorrow. I think you knew that was going to be the answer. I have heard that Buddhism discourages keeping pets because it creates attachment. Is that true? No, it's not. No, you know, it's sometimes the word attachment, if any attachment is bad, that's what happens, you know, in Buddhism. And so even when you send emails, you must never send any attachments. They're bad. No, sometimes keeping a cat, apparently the Dalai Lama's got a cat, and sometimes the cat can be just a very, or the cat or a dog or a bird or something can be very emotionally helpful for a person. You know, maybe if you're enlightened, you don't need sort of keeping a cat or a dog or a bird or whatever. But, you know, sometimes, I don't know, it's not that you keep a cat, it's more the closer to the truth that the cat keeps you. Adopts you, and it's more like the dog. And it's not as if you walk the dog takes you for a walk in the morning. So I don't know really who's the pet and who's the master. If you've had got a cat or dog, you know what I'm talking about. So there's always some downsides to it, some negatives. Yeah, it can create an attachment, and people who lose their cats or dogs. Oh, it's like a grief, like it's the grief that you lose a child. But nevertheless, it's got its downside, but it's got its good sides as well. They do teach you a lot about happiness and love and unconditional love. And there was that story I wrote about it in the Good, Bad, Who Knows book. There was a woman just came home from the shops with the week's groceries and got them out of the car, and her hands were full of the groceries. She managed to get the key and open the door of her house, and a dog ran past. A dog she did not know ran past her and into her house. She couldn't stop it. She had her hands full of groceries. So, you know, she was surprised, but, you know, she went inside and put the groceries down and went looking for the dog. And she saw the dog in a room, curled up in a corner, fast asleep. And then she liked dogs. I think it was one of these Labradors. It was really clean. It wasn't a stray. It had a collar on. And, you know, why not let this lovely dog just take a nap in her house? So, you know, she unpacked the groceries and just relaxed. And after about an hour or two, a little bark, no, not a loud bark, aggressive bark, a little bark came from the dog. The dog had woken up, so she opened the door and let the dog out. And the dog went away. And she thought, that's really weird. But, you know, that it's no kind looking at dogs. And if the dog did that to me and came into my hut, of course, let it in, because, you know, it's kindness, compassion. And the dog doesn't harm you. So anyway, the dog came the same time the next day. So she let it in, it went to the same corner, curled up, went to sleep. It was like an act of compassion from this woman. About three or four times that happened. And the fourth time it happened, you know, she got curious. Why does this dog, it was very clean, you know, it was obviously well looked after and it wasn't hungry, but incredibly well behaved. It just came into a corner and sat down, curled up and just went to sleep. So she wondered, should she follow that dog and find out where it lived? But she thought, no, she's got a much better idea. She got a piece of paper like this, and she wrote the note, said, whoever owns this dog, it's a lovely dog, and it's been coming to visit me every afternoon around the same time to take a sleep for an hour. I'm just curious, you know, why? And so she folded the note up and put it under the collar. So when the dog went away, you know, the dog was the post dog. And the following day, the dog came back again for the fifth time, and there was a different note in the collar. So, you know, she let the dog sort of go to sleep, and she took out the new note and opened it and got the answer. The answer was, you know, this is my dog. We live a couple of blocks away. I have a really busy wife and about six or seven kids who are just on school holidays, and they're really noisy, and they just climb all over the dog and play with him when he just wants to have a nice easy time. He comes to your house to take a rest. Can I come too? Signed the husband. You can imagine the little kids playing with dogs, and the poor dog just tolerates them. Oh, please, can I have a rest? Anyway, can reading suttas decrease our bad karma? No, they can't decrease just by reading a sutta. But what it can do is if you understand it and you get inspired and follow the instructions, and then, of course, that can decrease your bad karma. But, you know, got to understand it, first of all, and practice it afterwards. If a wealthy person who's born rich is due to good karma, then why do some rich people behave so bad if they had such good karma from the previous life? That's my understanding is that, you know, if a person has been a really generous person in their past life, looked after other people, not been so concerned about themselves, then it's like the life just endows you with wealth in this life because it thinks you know how to look after your wealth. It's not just for you. It's for, you know, sharing with others. But if you don't make good use of your wealth in this life, in other words, you squander it, or you just, you know, use it for your own enjoyment and just don't really share it with others who need it, then, of course, you know, you failed the test. Like wealth is like a gift to see if you know how to use it for the benefit of others. Oh, for your own family and well-being as well, but mostly for others. And if you don't use it wisely in your next life, you won't be entrusted with wealth anymore. Please advise how we can achieve a target such as a sales quota if we don't chase what we want in the business world. Business people have told me that like sales quotas, even like being successful in business, is always getting that relationship of trust. In other words, your clients or the people you're selling things to, they, you know, they realize that, you know, that you're going to produce the goods, and what you tell them that the goods will do will actually, you know, they will do that task and they will arrive on time. So you can get a sales quota temporarily by lying and convincing a person that your product is much better than everybody else's when it's not. But then you lose that client later. They don't trust you. And a lot of times it's building up that trustworthiness. The fact that they just know that they can feel that what you say is what you can do. And that means that you have a lot of loyal customers. And even if you can get that product cheaper somewhere else, it doesn't matter, that loyalty, that personal connection with the seller and the buyer is really important psychologically. You go back to that shop again and again and again. It's not because you're not saving money, you're actually spending more money. But the fact that these are people you trust makes a huge difference. So unfortunately, that many of the companies these days, they're just impersonal. And they're automatic checkouts. You just choose a thing yourself, or you just log in online and it's delivered to your door. You don't see people anymore. But some people prefer that people interaction. That social connection. It used to be the local post offices. They would know everything about what was going on in the town. So people would come there, wouldn't just actually come and post their letters or buy stamps. But it was like a nice place where people would almost like meet, a social club. Or they used to have these corner shops when I was a kid. And families would own these shops. Yeah, they're supposed to keep certain hours, but they'd always say, oh, you know, we know you. If you need anything at the last moment or on a Sunday, just knock on the door and we'll give it for you, to you. And it was a beautiful, like a community social shop. So sales quotas, targets. You know what happens if you meet that target, you really work hard and you do really well and you meet that target, what happens? Raise the target. You have to work harder next week. And you can't always do that, and it's a crazy life. But that's actually what you can do. You can do, you get your beautiful person, you're very kind and you're honest. And that was one of my cousins. He was a salesman, and he was a fellow when I went to visit him in Stoke-on-Trent in Midlands of England. He was a salesman for some washing machine company or something. And he said, you know, built up the relationships with all the shops, so they trusted him. And he told me that sometimes you go in a shop and you feel straight away, no, it's not the right time. You get out straight away, you don't push it. You know, when they were really busy or just really stressed out, that's the last one they want to see is a salesman. But other times he would go in there and just, they respected him, he respected them. And so he got lots of sales, he did really well. In fact, I remember one of his colleagues was, you know, also a saleswoman, and so he married her, and they lived very happily. But anyway, when I was visiting him, it was a Sunday morning, and so we went for a walk and some exercise. I didn't take my arms bowl because you wouldn't get any food, but, you know, just having a nice bit of exercise, and I'm meeting my old cousin, and just chatting about all sorts of things. But I noticed something really strange, that people in that town were looking at me, but they weren't sort of averting their eyes or walking over the other side of the street. They're looking at me, pointing and laughing. For some reason or another, I made them, you know, really laugh. And I never had that response anywhere else in the world at any other time except on that one day in that city in the middle of England. And I couldn't understand why until I saw the reason why. As we turned a corner, there was this big billboard, an advertisement for the circus. And they thought I was one of the clowns, dressed in my robes. So I didn't mind, because I was making people laugh that day. Anyway, oops. Why do I get hurt so easily by what people say or do? How can I get stronger? Number one. If people call you stupid, why do you get upset? The reason is because you think they may be right. That's no joke. That's why you get hurt. Imagine, you know, it was some really crazy person, just, you know, who was mad, and they called you stupid. It wouldn't hurt at all, because you know that they don't know what they're talking about. That's why, number one, it's because you believe them. Number two, sometimes they may be right, but, you know, you do a stupid thing. You're not a stupid person, but you can do a stupid thing. And so, why do you get upset? Why do you get hurt so easily? Because you remember it. So, it's just very simple. It's an example, and you can apply it. It gets more complicated in other places. You know, somebody says, you know, you're lazy. And then you think, I'm not lazy. I'm the last person who's lazy. Maybe they're lazy, but it's not right they call me lazy. It's not appropriate they call me lazy. And they suddenly figure out they've just called you lazy 6 more times. Every time you remember it. they call you lazy again. You're obsessed with it. You allow them to hurt you. In business, somebody cheats you. You lose some money. They cheated me. They should have cheated. I shouldn't let myself be cheated like that again. And they can't cheat me. And you realize every time you remember that, you're allowing them to hurt you and cheat you out of your happiness every time you remember it. So they cheated you, learn from it, and forget it, move on. So they don't do it again. But don't keep obsessing, because then they're hurting you every time you recall it. They're taking away your happiness. What was it, about a year ago, a Bodhinyana monastery, a thief came in and stole some tools from our workshop. You know, just the other side of, many of you have been over there already. And they stole tools, and valuable tools. And so, you know, it was number one, we couldn't do a lot of work the next week. So actually the monks were quite happy. Take some time off. And also, but I told them, it's bad karma to steal from a monastery. And some people started getting unhappy and getting angry. And I said, look, they can steal tools, but don't let them steal your happiness. What's more important? So don't let them steal happiness from you. And anyway, you know what happened in the end? That the insurance came along, they were all insured, and the insurance gave us a payout for all the stolen tools, so we could get new ones. Much better, and actually cheaper. Which meant that we upgraded our tools, and actually we had a profit afterwards. And I know I should not say this, but if we ever find out who that burglar was, we'd invite him back. You can't do that. So that sometimes we allow ourselves to get hurt when it's not necessary. So first of all, if someone says something about you, what do they know? So don't believe them. And if you do believe them, someone calls you stupid and you get upset, they were right. And if they say something which is hard to... And it's also, they say you're stupid or you're fat or something, just don't get upset. If they say you're a pig, oink, oink. Because they say those things to try and upset you, to try and take away your happiness. And if you refuse to allow your happiness to be taken away, if you refuse to getting upset is your choice. It's not their choice to make you upset. It's your choice that you will get upset. So you can refuse to get upset. Say, no, I'm not going to get upset by what you say. I'm not going to give you that satisfaction. And then after a while they don't bother you anymore. You just await. They might as well try and get a lamppost to be upset. Or try and criticize a tree. You're too tall. Tree doesn't do anything, it just stays there. So this is a way that we don't allow those words of people who don't know us to upset us. But the last thing, obviously, is Ajahn Chah's saying that this is when he taught me one of the worst things you can call a person in many countries, in Thailand, northeast Thailand, is call him a dog. You dog. And he said, if anyone ever does that to you, Ajahn Brahm, they call you a dog, don't get upset yet. Have a look at your bottom. See if you've got a tail. No, I haven't got a tail, so sorry, sir, you're wrong. I'm not a dog. So simple, but you know, that's really important. And lastly, that case of this, in northeastern Thailand, Ubon, there was actually a US Air Force base during the Vietnam War. And this was a true story which went around that town, and Ajahn Chah heard it and thought it was a brilliant story and told everybody. one of the Afro-American GIs there, he was going from the base into town and on a cycle rickshaw. And halfway on the journey, the driver of the cycle rickshaw was passing some of his friends who were just taking a break and drinking Mekong whiskey, getting drunk. And because they were getting drunk and they saw this big Afro-American soldier, huge guy, they just said, "Hey, where are you taking that dirty dog to?" That was racist. And it was just, you know, if that soldier could understand Thai, or it was actually Lao in that part of the world, if he could, that was a fight. No one would stand for that. So the driver was really worried for a while. He turned around and saw this soldier, just looking at the scenery, not being concerned, and assumed the soldier didn't understand the language. So he decided to have a bit of fun. "See how dirty this dog is? I'm going to throw him in the river in town for a good wash." And they laughed, ha ha ha. The soldier just looking around, enjoying the scenery. When they got into town, the soldier got out of the rickshaw and started walking away without paying. And the rickshaw driver shouted out, "Hey, sir, money, you got to pay me." And that's when the soldier turned around and said in fluent Thai language, "Dogs don't have money." And walked away. It's true, dogs don't have money, they don't have to pay. So that's how you deal with abuse, you don't get hurt. Is it better to give in to obsessive people, or should I speak up for what I believe is right? It depends who the oppressive person is. If that oppressive person has got a gun, you just, "Oh, no, no, I agree with you." It depends on the situation. There's many ways of solving problems, but sometimes not right away. Just, you know, just leave it for a while and then take your opportunity later on. Because sometimes people could be oppressive, and sometimes you find out, why are they oppressive? You know, is it because that there's something about you, or is it they are suffering? They're under stress. You know, that sometimes you see people who look like they're really misbehaving and they're not very unkind person, and then you actually find out why. There was this story I mean, it was actually in Daniel Goleman's Emotional Intelligence a long time ago. There was an American fellow who went to learn Japanese martial arts. When the martial arts are never supposed to be used for aggression, they're only supposed to be used, you know, for self-defense at most. And as he was on one of the subways, that this drunken man just pushed aside a pregnant woman to get a seat. And this American thought, now this is unacceptable. This is one time when I should be justified in using my martial arts. So he squared up to this Japanese man and said in broken Japanese, "You can't do that." And the drunken man just squared up to him, was about to be a fight. And this old gentleman who was sitting down sort of moved over and invited the drunken man, "Oh, come and sit by me, I have some sake." And so the drunken man just decided to have a drink of sake rather than beat up or have a fight with the American. And the old man just gave the sake and said, "You know, I used to love drinking sake with my wife at this time of the year, but my wife passed away recently." And the drunken man said, "So did my wife pass away only a few months ago, and I haven't got a job now, and I'm so sad." And in just those few little words, the old Japanese man had understood where that violence and no concern for anyone other than himself came from. He was alone, suffering, the grief of a lost one. It was a reason behind it. And you find that out, there was no need for a fight. Everybody had a reason for their bad behavior. And when you found out what that reason was, then the bad behavior could stop. Anyway, I thought that was emotional intelligence. To give it to obsessive people, or should I speak up for what I believe is right? How about understanding why people are oppressive? Why do people do these things, if at all possible? Ajahn, can you please explain why only one Buddha comes up at a time? For example, Buddha Kaspa, the next one is Buddha Gautama, and so on. It's because the first one who comes up when there's no other Buddhas around becomes a Buddha. It's like a vacant position. You can't have two presidents of the United States at the same time. Thank goodness. So when one goes away, then the position is vacant for somebody else to come. Should I stay away from bad people or be accommodating and kind to get along with them? If you've got enough energy, just like a good elephant, if you stay around with bad elephants or bad people, you become bad yourself. But if you've got a lot of good energy and a good monk, you can go into a prison and you can just, your energy is so much good energy in your fuel tank that, all the prisoners, they come and they deplete your fuel, but you've got plenty left after you leave prison, which means that all those bad people, like the elephant associated with good people, they become much better. So that's an important thing, that know your limits, know that how much energy, goodness you have and how much you can do. But if, you're always with a lot of bad people, again and again and again, you get sort of sucked dry. What they call it, like vampires. And it's like the vampires of bad people, they suck your goodness, keep sucking, sucking, sucking until you've got nothing left. So some people, they go home from work and they're just drained. So what to do? So before you get that drained, you just take a few minutes in the restroom. If you haven't got a good person around, get out your iPad, iPhone, and listen to you-know-who. And get a big boost of energy. And then you go home afterwards and you're fine. But sometimes you can't avoid bad people. But sometimes you were a bad person before. And you had good people to teach you and help you and inspire you. And you changed. So if you can, it's nice to be with people who are not really bad, but they're just a bit confused. And they need a bit of assistance. If you can give it, great. Dear Ajahn, I know it is me who disturbs the noise, but... Why is there buts? But not the other way around. But can you kindly ask the retreatants not to zip the bags inside the meditation hall, as it's really very noisy? Also, can you please ask all the retreatants to take off the noisy coat before they enter the meditation hall? The noise becomes like the sound of thunder when one is meditating. Thank you, Ajahn. Yeah. It's nice to be able to do that if you possibly can. But, that sometimes it's good that people are trying to be kind and being sensitive to others. And so, just because I say it's not the noise disturbs you, it's you disturb the noise, doesn't mean that you go around banging every door and gonging the dong and just talking and just shouting and just, I'm going to test everybody out. So it's out of compassion and kindness. Sometimes people get so deep in the meditation, and sometimes a tiny noise can actually disturb them. It's out of kindness, and you can do that. You can be sort of quiet. Often say that burglars, they can come in and out of a house and no one hears them, and they're bad characters. If a bad character like a burglar can do that, surely you can do better than that. And anyway, so many people, it's hard to get employment these days. If you come here and you learn how to zip a bag without anybody hearing it, open the door and no one knows you're coming. you can get a good job in the Secret Service of Hong Kong or Indonesia. So it gives you more opportunities for advancement in your work. My husband and my sister do not get along very well. They can't stand to be near with each other. They put me in a difficult situation, your husband and your sister. Every time we have family gatherings and so on. How do you respond to this? It's nothing to do with your question, because it's, but how you respond to it is, you know, they don't get along very well, and they can't stand to be near with each other. Sometimes it's nice to be able to look at one, your husband and your sister, and just to see beautiful things in them. Because this is the watering the weeds, not the flowers, and that makes the relationship very bad. Water the flowers and not the weeds. You can see beauty in everybody and get on with one another. There was, these stories. This one is a very nice story. When you go over to Bodhinyana Monastery, especially if you go there for lunch, those tables you see in the buffet hall, we might call it that, the stainless steel tables, they were offered by a gentleman from Brisbane in Queensland. And the story behind that was that I was passing through Brisbane and he invited me, you know, for the meal because, you know, I was just passing through very quickly. And so he said, oh, please come to my house for the meal. And so he made a big thing of it. And so I had my lunch there. But when I had my lunch, I was just chit-chatting and asked him, you know, how many children he's got. And he said he had 2 sons and I only saw one of them there. I said, where's your other son? And he just went sort of cold. And I asked his other son, I said, what's happening? He said, they had a big argument 7 years ago, him and his eldest son, and they haven't spoken to each other or seen each other in all those 7 years. And I said, why? He said, well, even I don't know, said the youngest son. And I asked the youngest son, well, do you speak to your older brother? He said, oh, yeah. And have you got his cell phone number? He said, yeah, call him now. I know because you're a monk, especially in Sri Lanka, they really respect you. They're actually scared of you. They don't want to make bad karma, so I knew that. So I said, call him now. And so he got through and said, give me the phone. And so I was talking, I said, this is Ajahn Brahm. You know who I am? Ajahn Brahm, yeah. Because I wrote many books, my nickname in Sri Lanka is the Smiling White Monk. Didn't know that. You can ask any Sinhalese that. But anyway, I use that sort of reputation. And I said, this is Ajahn Brahm here. I'm at your father's house. You've got to come now. And I hung up. So the elder son had no choice. He had to come. And he came in, he's not that far away, came in about 15 minutes. He came into his father's house, the first time they'd been that close physically for 7 years. He said, sit down next to your dad. And he did. He had to, because I ordered him. It'd be bad karma if he disobeyed me. But they would look at each other. You know, one was looking this way, the other one was looking the other way. And so I started with the father, and he said, what happened? I think, no, they were the eldest son, first of all. What happened? Why haven't you seen each other or talked to each other for 7 years? And this is true. It's, life is just so crazy that, you know, it's mad. So what did you do 7 years ago? And the eldest son said, I can't remember. Honestly, that's how mad this family life is. I can't remember, but I don't want to see my father. And then asked the father, well, what did you do? What happened? He said, I can't remember either. And how crazy this is. I said, okay, turn around and look at one another. There's no asking forgiveness or blaming because it's gone way beyond that now. Just reconcile your father and son. So they did, and they hugged. And that was the end of that problem. And of course, bringing the family together. Father and son hadn't seen each other or spoken together for 7 years. And that's, you know, when he came over to Perth, the father, he just donated all those tables. You know, just thank you so much. Got my family back again. Little things like that. And why do people do that? They don't really remember what a person did or who started it or what happened. It's just, I don't like you anymore. I can't understand this life. Anyway, you don't get along very well. Why not? Just because of past someone something did, and you always look upon that, your family member, and just, yeah, you know, you try to be nice to your family member, and just, what does he want by that? You know, he's up to some games, you know, when you try and be nice to you. And, oh, what was it? They were telling, this a psychologist told me this. If you want to praise your wife, it takes about 17 seconds. You know, especially if you've been married for a while, you've got to keep praising, you're a wonderful woman, I'm very lucky that you're my wife, it's great that you married me, you're a wonderful cook. That's not enough. That's only about 6 seconds. You've got to keep on going until, you know, that actually it starts going through the barrier. What does he mean by this? You know, what's he up to? He's done something wrong, I'm sure. That's why he's trying to praise me. It's because sometimes that we just distrust one another these days. And we just don't like receiving praise. I don't know why. So that's why that, you know, it's got to be sincere and persisting with praise and say, look, I don't know why we get argued with one another, we're blood. You know, and they're, well, we're at least related to one another by marriage. Surely we can get on together. And whatever happened in the past, just let it go. Be kind to it. We may have misunderstood what you said. So that way that we can get on together, your husband and sister. But I don't know why people do this. If you go to, again, Boating the Iron Monastery, in the wall there, we actually just inter ashes in there. So when somebody dies, you know, they can put the ashes in there so they can come there and just remember their loved ones. And so that there was one Chinese man, and when he died, you know, his wife interred her in the wall. And then she said, you know, I'm also really sick. You know, I'm going to be sort of dying soon. I said, oh, should I reserve a spot for you underneath, you know, the next thing down underneath your husband? And she went, no way! I've been underneath that man for the last 40 years. I want another pillar. The further the way, the better, she said. And I couldn't believe that. It's only your ashes. Your ashes aren't going to fight together. Anyway, can you please give more guided meditations? Okay, I'll try that for tomorrow. Does meditation help people with insecurities in life or others or how one ranks themselves among others? Of course it does. When you realize all this ranking, it just the simile of the trees, which is the best tree? Okay, that's which is the best finger in my hand? For those of you who don't know this one, can you rank the fingers in a hand? So, the story is, the five fingers were having an argument. Who is the superior finger, the best finger in the hand? This started. I am the best finger. I'm the opposable thumb. Allows people to pick up things and to make tools. Not many animals have the opposable thumb. And also, I may be small, but I'm really strong. And if you ever say, okay, you use me. I am the okay finger. I am the best. And so that was a pretty good argument. But then this one said, nope, I'm the best finger. I am the index finger. The finger of wisdom. I point things out to people. And also, if you say number one, you put me up. Number one. I'm the number one finger. You look at that, we haven't got a statue of, you know, the Buddha being taking his seven steps. That's the thing he's got up. The number one finger. And this third finger said, no, I am the best finger. I am the middle finger, middle way is the best. I am the tallest, I see further. And if you want to know how powerful I am, just put me up the other way. And everyone takes notice of me. I am the most important finger. And then this finger said, no, I am the most important finger, because I am the finger of love. When you get engaged, I get the engagement ring. When you get married, I get the wedding ring. I'm the finger of love. Without love, where would this world be? Love, looking at something much bigger than you, the family. That is why I'm the most important finger. I'm the finger of love. And then that left the last finger, the little one. I know sometimes things which are so small, people think are insignificant. But this one said, actually, I am the most important finger of all five. Even though you use me to do dirty things. Still they say, I'm the most important, because when you pay respects to the Buddha, I am always closest to the Buddha. So there's no most important finger, but sometimes it's nice when the smallest one wins. And if you do the dirty stuff, you're always closest to the Buddha. So those of you who do the washing up, who clean the toilets, you are closest to the Buddha. But all those rankings and stuff, you don't really... Have you ever noticed who's the most senior monk in a monastery? You know, you know me because, you know, you've seen me many times, but who's the most senior? We all wear the same robes. We don't have, like, special robes for senior monks. And for real senior monks, you know, or like, you have, like, stripes, like in the army of authority. It's one of the nice things that when you look at a monk, and you know, sometimes you ask, how long have you been a monk? You don't know by what they look like. So there's, you know, the seniority is there just for, you know, when it comes to, you know, where you walk in the line. But other than that, we never think that just because you're older as a monk that you're more superior. And I quite like that idea. It's very much that all the monks would get together and you wouldn't know who's the most senior and who's the least senior. Can we count our breath to help us stay with our breath? Yeah, you can count your breath, but sometimes it depends. If you're an accountant, then you get your sort of your iPhone out and just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. No, counting the breath is like saying breathing in, long, breathing out, long, or breathing in, peace, breathing out, let go. These are just ways of just making the breath a little bit more interesting. But the problem with counting, after a while, it gets pretty tiring. So if it works for you, fine, give it a try. Dear Ajahn, from all the Buddhas, why do we only follow the Dhamma from Siddhartha Gautama, not the other Buddhas? Because that's just the most modern, believe it or not, 2,500 years. And it's also because, you know, the new Buddha only arises when the old Buddha and the Dhamma just disappears and is no longer here. So even now, there's no Buddha alive today, but the Dhamma is still alive. So we don't need another Buddha until we just lose all the Dhamma, all the teachings. And then, after a while, another Buddha will arise. Can the Buddha be female? Yes, exactly. So, who knows? Catholics confess their sins to their priests. What is the practice of Buddhism for confession? It's you, a lot of times, you confess to yourself. Because even actually acknowledging it to a priest can't forgive you. I can't forgive you. The Buddha statue can't forgive you. There's only one person in the world which can forgive you, and that's yourself. When you acknowledge and realize you're a human being, you make mistakes. And mistakes are part of life. Hands up here, anyone here has never made a mistake. Of course you've made mistakes. And I tell that story of being a school teacher and setting an exam and being told by a senior teacher, don't make the exam too easy. If everyone gets 100%, it's a waste of time doing the exam. And if everybody gets, you know, 50% or 40%, it's such a hard exam, your students will come out afterwards thinking they can't do maths. They'll lose their confidence. So he said, your job as a teacher is to aim, the sweet mark is 70%. And if the average is 70% in your class, people think 70%, that's not bad, they can do maths. And the 30% where they make mistakes, when I read those mistakes, I found that a lot of them are the same. It means I need to focus on that part of maths in my next lessons. The mistakes are not there to have a feeling of inadequacy. The mistakes are there to find out where your weak points are so you can learn and strengthen them. It's where we grow, recognizing our mistakes. So, you don't do sins, we just make mistakes, we're human beings. And so you confess to yourself, you bring it up, oh yeah, I did that. And you don't feel bad about it. You think, oh yeah, you know, I need to sort of really work on this part of my life. So that means you get better and better and better, you're always improving. And that's straight from the Buddha's teachings. He said, acknowledging your mistakes, forgiving them and learning from them is called growth in the Buddha's teachings. You acknowledge them first, but you don't punish yourself for them. Punish yourself for them means you don't want to confess them anymore. Because you feel ashamed, or you want to get punished. And that's really a crazy way of living. So that's a Buddhist confession. So you come and tell anybody. And this, that story in one of the books about the Anagarika, the people in white. If you go over to Bodhinyana, you see these people in white. They're not cricketers. They're training to be monks. And there was this poor young man one day. I felt so sorry for him. He came up to me in the morning and he said, oh, I did a terrible thing last night. And you know, I broke my precepts and I haven't been able to sleep all night. I need to confess it to you now. I said, well, what have you done? And he said, last night, he was hungry. And he snuck into the kitchen. He made himself a sandwich, and he ate it. Have you been hungry in the evening? I've been hungry in the evening, but unfortunately, when I was training as a young monk, there were no sandwiches. Otherwise, probably I might have eaten one, I don't know. But you felt so sorry for this young man. He was young, he was really hungry, and so I said, look, it's wonderful that you've actually confessed to me. You brought it up because now we can actually fix up the problem. So number one, eat more food at lunchtime. Number one. And number two, there's all these loopholes. You can have some honey, you can have some cheese, you can have some chocolate, you can have some oranges. There's so much stuff which is allowable in the evening. And sometimes you go out there in the evening and on people on eight precepts, you see, they the amazing amount of stuff which you can eat in the afternoon and the evening. And he asked, well, why can I eat cheese but not milk? And why can I do this and instead of yogurt? And, oh, it gets so complicated. So I usually go and say, well, go and ask Ajahn Bambadio. I pass the buck. Fed up with asking those questions. But anyway, I told him all the things you can eat. And I said, okay, so, you know, you're forgiven. Never mind, it's not a big thing. But then he would not take that. He said, no, that's not good enough. He said, I need a penance. I need to be punished, he said. Because if you don't punish me, I'll do it again. Now, some people are like that. They've grown up thinking if there's no penalty there, they're free to do it again. So it was a really hard case. And so I had no choice. I had to find a punishment for him. And I was reading a novel about the early history in Australia. They send these convicts over from England, and they would treat them brutally. If they did anything wrong, they got a flogging, you know, with this whip they call the cat of nine tails. And it was brutal. But I'd just been reading this book. And I said, well, you know, if you want a punishment, we'll give you a traditional Australian punishment. 50 strokes of the cat. I said that. And this guy obviously didn't understand what Buddhism was all about, because his face drained of colour. You know, the lip starts quivering. For some reason, he really thought that I was going to whip him. And then I told him, said, this is what 50 strokes of the cat mean in a Buddhist monastery. We had two cats at that time. Find any one of them. Wow. Two strokes, three. Learn some compassion and kindness, you know, from a cat. If you don't want to do 50 strokes of the cat, 50 strokes of the teddy bear. One. And if you've been really bad breaking all your precepts, 100 strokes of the teddy bear. Because the reason why people break these rules is because they're not kind. They haven't got enough compassion. So now you know what punishment is like in a monastery. Why do monks or nuns need to go to the extreme of living in a cave or sometimes torture themselves in their practice? What do they actually practice? We don't torture themselves. When was the last time you saw me torture myself? So, but what I do, the cave is not an extreme. The cave is a wonderful place to live. You know, sometimes I actually thought of this because, you know, every now and again we want to raise funds for this or for that. I never raise funds for myself, I raise funds for something, some other good cause. And so I thought, you know, when I'm on retreat, teaching a retreat here, I stay in the teacher's cottage. There's no one in my cave. So I can actually rent it out like Airbnb. Imagine that. I mean, how much would you pay to stay the night in Ajahn Brahm's cave? And that'd be a lot of money that people would auction that off. But why do I stay in the cave? It's really comfortable, it's simple, and most importantly, it's peaceful. And I do get sort of disturbed, you know, by people all over the place, and for good reason. They want some help with their meditation or something. And when I go in my cave, you can knock on the outside door, you can't hear it on the inside. It really is silent. And it's really nice and cool. And most importantly, you know in Biff in Hong Kong, that you get me these really posh hotels. And I don't need those. But never now, you just get me these nice places I can stay. What was it just when I went on this executive retreat? Remember in executive retreat in Phuket? it took me a long time. At last, you know, the Angie Monksfield, she actually, it wasn't really her fault, because the hotel manager, oh, it's a senior Buddhist monk coming, we've got to give him the best room in the house. And the best room of the house was with the beach views. And it wasn't the beach views, it was the young girls and young boys views. Where people were cavorting around in the evening. And I just, so I just closed the curtains. I never opened them for the whole time I was there, for 8 or 9 days. What do you want a beach view or sea view for? You don't even look at it as a monk. So this time they gave me a room which had no sea view at all. That was really much, much nicer. So I could just meditate. Instead of having the beach views or sea views or ocean views, I could have my inside view, which is much more appropriate for monks. So in my cave, there's no views at all. Can't see outside. And actually, there is a nice airflow through there if you figure it out how it works. It's very, very high-tech, sort of. But it gives me, reminds me that I'm just a monk. You know, sleeping on the floor, just living in a nice, calm, peaceful place with hardly any possessions. It reminds me just, I'm a monk. I'm not a celebrity, no matter what you think, I'm a monk. And I would go there and always remind myself of that. And that's why I enjoy being there. And peaceful and calm, that's basically where I belong. Anyways, it's not torture. It's torture living in a five-star hotel room. You know, you see, just look at all the TVs you can't turn on. Jacuzzi. Where was I recently? And I saw at this rich person's house in San Francisco and had a jacuzzi. And I looked at it and said, well, what does that button do? What does that? Oh, no, it's really scary. I didn't know which buttons it does. I have all these jets of water coming out. No way. That was really scary for me. And what do you want that for anyway? Just sit under a shower. That's good enough. You get clean. So that's why, as a monk, you're used to simplicity. And you love simplicity. It would be torture to put me in a six-star hotel. Wouldn't know what to do. Like you mentioned, actually, that sometimes I look at the TV in the five-star hotel rooms. I confess I do. Are you shocked? I go right up to it, I look at it, and I see a reflection of my face in it. I don't turn it on. Try the next time you're in a hotel room. Look at the TV, but don't turn on the electricity. And you see who you really are. It's very deep. Like you mentioned this morning, hey? Like you mentioned this morning, mindfulness and meditation have become a big trend in the West. Many New Age teachers. You know, all these New Age teachers I see, they're really old. Right, to be honest, they're old age teachers. Life coaches and companies are making mega dollars off the training. Wouldn't it be dangerous if one teaches mindfulness or meditation without Buddhism teaching? Oh, we talk about that so often. One of the problems is that there's a lot of monks and they're not doing any teaching. And so sometimes, you know, think it's maybe the monks' faults, because they're not getting out there and sharing their wisdom and knowledge with others, and the nuns as well. And so there's a vacuum there of people who want to make a buck out of this. So anyway, it's dangerous, yeah, but it's not that too dangerous. Because, you know, to get the real deep teachings, the powerful mindfulness, you know, you have to, you know, be much more than a life coach. That's when you get the superpower mindfulness stuff. That's a juicy part. And after a while, people hear that and they realize that you have to put the Buddhism back, you know, into the meditation to get the powerful mindfulnesses of letting go, of keeping your precepts, being kind, you know, not sort of worrying about financial rewards, but you're giving up, you're letting go. It's not about you, it's about us. So that's where some of this stuff really comes and empowers your meditation. I know there's a young man I'm not supposed to mention sitting in the back, oops, who's going to become a novice soon. And, oh, that's not the novice training, this is the monk training. There is some nuns over in Dhammasara who are going to take the bhikkhuni ordination soon. And part of the chanting we do is, what is it called? Oh my goodness. Samadhi. Oh. It's when your meditation is supported by wisdom. No, sorry, I got it wrong. It's almost time to go to bed. Or jet lag. 9:26. When your meditation is supported by virtue, it's of great power and great benefit. And when your wisdom is supported by meditation, it's a great power and great benefit. It is actually saying that in this, you know, Sila Samadhi Panya, this virtue, peace and compassion, they actually support one another. And when, especially your meditation, focusing on meditation, mindfulness, peace, stillness, when it's supported by virtuous, good conduct, kindness, generosity, forgiveness, compassion, that has a huge effect on the depth and power of your meditation. That's why you do keep 5 precepts or 8 precepts. We don't do that forcefully. If you need something in the evening, fine. It's kindness, but you're a good person. You're a person who is sort of sensitive, so you don't make too much noise when you come in the room. That type of person, pure-hearted person, when they meditate, whoa, their meditation takes off. That's what it means when virtue supports meditation. It's not just mindfulness. It's the virtue comes in and the kindness as well. That really makes you a very powerful meditator. So in mindfulness training, they realize that. And so after a while, that it's not just sitting down, being mindful and training that to the US military so that they can actually shoot more accurately and kill with less bullets. That's really gross. But, you know, sometimes that you realize the virtue, the goodness. Without that, the meditation tends to fall apart. It's not strong, it's not powerful. And that's straight from the Buddha's teachings, and that always reassures me, reassures you that just mindfulness by itself is lacking something. Is forgiveness a must? Can I forgive myself for not forgiving? Yeah, of course you can. I forgive you for that. So, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good, thank you. Oh, sorry, I forgot. Ha ha ha. Yeah. Very good, I wish you a very pleasant night. And see you in the morning. Thank you for the call. Hey, I did this one already, didn't I?